The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finn, and we've got a great show for you. We're getting ready for Passover, believe it or not. So that's what we're going to be talking about a little bit today. In this half hour of the show, we're going to be talking with Professor Yochanan Petrovsky Stern about the shtetl. He wrote a book about, the definitive book about the shtetl, and we're going to be talking to him about that. We have lots of eclectic Jewish music. The portion of the week, we're beginning in the book of Leviticus 1:1 and following with a portion of Vayikra. We have a really encapsulating Hasidic story at the end. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. With elections this week in Israel, polls show left-leaning Labor ahead of Netanyahu's Likud party 26 to 22 seats. Whichever party gets the most seats gets to form the new government. A coalition of 61 seats is required. The ban of imported white cement into Gaza was lifted for the first time in 7 years. Portland cement, as it's called, has dual use and can be used for making terror tunnels. Reports show that Hamas is rebuilding its tunnel network. In the meantime, Gaza began exporting vegetables to Israel for the first time in 8 years. You get tomatoes, we get terror tunnels in order to kill you. Yes. The U.S. State Department awarded a $1 million grant to the New Israel Fund. This is not a good thing. To pay for lobbying and diversification in Israel. The New Israel Fund has knowingly financed groups that support the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, known as the BDS, and try to have Israeli soldiers prosecuted for war crimes during the last Gaza war. Erica Rosenberg, the legal heir to the estranged wife of Oscar Schindler, is suing Yad Vashem to return a suitcase full of documents belonging to Schindler. The Holocaust Memorial says that the suitcase was given away to a friend of Schindler before Schindler passed away. That suitcase was later given to Yad Vashem, who says that Rosenberg is a serial sewer and is interested in selling the papers. I don't think there is a word, serial sewer, but, you know, it's like, you know, there's a sewer that the water goes down, but, you know, but to say someone who sues on a regular basis is a sewer, I don't think that's English, but that's, listen, Yad Vashem's in Israel. Hainan Airlines, China's largest private carrier, plans to offer 3 direct flights weekly from Beijing to Tel Aviv beginning in September. The goal is for 100,000 Chinese tourists to visit Israel yearly. Israel's foreign ministry is working that travel between the two countries would not require a visa. And finally, only in Israel, a Jewish man was fined $250 and lost his license for 4 months for praying while driving in Jerusalem. The man was wearing his tefillin and tallis and charged with endangerment while operating a motor vehicle. The judge remarked that she did not believe the man's prayers were helping his driving. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We have on line with Professor Dr. Yochanan Petrovsky Stern. He's written a book called The Golden Age Shtetl, A New History of Jewish Life in Eastern Europe. How are you today, Yochanan?
I'm doing fine, Rabbi Herschel.
That's great. Good to hear. Good to hear.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is our pleasure. Whenever you had a fascinating topic, then, I mean, I'm on the air now for 18 years, and I have never done a show about the shtetl, but I have always wanted to do a show about the shtetl, and I didn't know who to contact. But
So you just lost 18 years for nothing.
That's, well, it's, I'm looking at it as we've gained another 18 years to go on.
Okay.
So, the listen, it says the preparation is also very important. So we've been preparing for 18 years to get to this point. Okay, right. Enough jocularity. There's a lot of mythology behind the shtetl. And in talking to you, you said this, that your book takes the fiddler off the roof. There's a lot of mythology about how great the shtetl was. And there's a lot of mythology about how awful the shtetl was. So before we do anything else, just for our listening audience, let's back up way back and let's describe what is, let's define, what is a shtetl as opposed to, say, a shtut or a dorf or some other place where people in Europe live?
Oh, okay, Rabbi Herschel. I thought that we should start perhaps with the memories, with a very bad and very nice memories of the shtetl, but we can get to this point a little bit later. Now, what is the shtetl and how it is different from the shtot, which is a city, and from a dorf, which is a village? According to my investigation and my very careful reading of the 18th and 19th century contemporary documents in Polish, Ukrainian, Russian, and other languages, the shtetl emerges as a Jewish version of what they call in Polish miasteczko, and what do they call in Ukrainian miasteczko, and what they call in Russian miasteczko. That is to say, a private Polish town which belongs to a nobleman, to a member of the Polish szlachta, of Polish nobility. We call these people the magnates. And it is primarily this particular arrangement where the town belongs to a magnate that the conceptualization of shtetl takes its roots.
Okay, so how did then did the shtetl, this sounds almost like a cooperative, how did the shtetl develop? When did people say stop living in towns, dorfs, or cities and then find themselves in shtetls?
Most of the Jews in the 17th, 18th, and early 19th century East Europe live not in the cities and not in the villages. They live in the shtetlach, in these private Polish towns. The story goes like follows. About 700 years ago, when the Polish kings allowed Jews to settle in Poland, they gave them rights to settle in towns and cities, mostly under crown control. And around late 15th, early 16th century, the local Catholic Church and the burghers, who really cannot compete with the Jewish merchants on the marketplace, decided to get for their cities a special privilegia, a special privilege, a special status, which is called de non tolerandi Judeos. That is to say, we do not tolerate Jews within the walls in the town. It was religiously framed but economically oriented privilege for the Christians in town, and Jews had to move from these big cities elsewhere. At that very point, Poland becomes one of the biggest, if not the biggest, countries of Europe, and the expansion implies that the king gives towns as gifts to the magnates. And magnates become the owners of the towns. And, of course, they need the infrastructure to be in place. They need trade. They need vodka production to be in place and many other industries to be there. And there is nothing there. So who would be doing, who will be taking care of all that? They think the Jews, the most mobile part of the population. So the Jews move from these big cities in central Poland to the private Polish towns that would later be called shtetlach in eastern Poland, in Lithuania, in what today is Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine. This is how things came to place.
Okay. What does the word pale of settlement mean? You also hear, this is an American expression, outside the pale. which refers to being outside the Pale of Settlement. What was the Pale of Settlement, Yohanan Petrovsky?
Right. It's a nice expression, outside the Pale. Outside the Pale also means that you are outside some of the imposed restrictions. The Pale of Settlement is the formerly Polish territory, which had been captured by Russia in course of the Polish partitions between 1772 and 1795. And this territory now, in the late 18th century, is no more Polish. It is already Russian. And Russia looks at this territory, which is its new western borderland, and asks a question. Well, what do we do? Before 1772, no Jews were allowed into the Russian Empire. Just no Jews, period. Now we inherited these huge territories, which represent 66% of the former Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth territory. So what do we do with these 1 million Jews that we inherited with these territories? We can banish them, but actually we cannot. It's physically impossible. On the other hand, we can legalize their presence. But let us allow the Jews to live just on these territories. So these territories in the western side of the Russian Empire, formerly Polish territories, now become what they call the Pale of Jewish Settlement. That is to say, the territory where Jews are legally allowed to settle within the boundaries of the Russian Empire. And these territories have established provinces. There are 15 provinces, and they constitute this institution. It's not just the territory, but it's the entire set of laws, regulations that we would call administrative institution, the Pale of Jewish Settlement.
Uh-huh. My bubby, my grandmother, was born in a small shtetl in what she described as northern Poland. It was called Czarna. I don't know if you know about the city Czarna. That's how she pronounced it, whether what is called today in modern Polish or Russian. But she spoke six languages. She spoke Polish instead of from Yiddish. She spoke Yiddish, Polish, Ukrainian, Lithuanian, Russian. I asked her, why do you speak so many languages? And she said, well, it really depended on what day of the week as to what country I was living in. Because sometimes she was living, she never moved, but sometimes she was living in Poland, sometimes she was living in Lithuania, sometimes she was living in Russia. What was the deal with that? What was going on politically with this, with the back and forth with these shtetlach in the Pale of Shtetl, Pale of Settlement, Yochanan and Petrovsky Stern?
Most likely your grandmother lived not in northern part of the Pale of Settlement, but is in central part. Somewhere on the territory between what today is Ukraine, Belarus, and Poland. And this territory changed hands many times in the course of the 20th century. It could be in Czechoslovakia, or in Hungary, or in Ukraine, or in the Soviet Union, or in the Austrian Empire, or in the independent Poland. Especially the region behind the Carpathian Mountains, so the so-called Transcarpathia, would change hands very often between 1917 and 1939, I would say 1945. In addition to that, the town Czarna, which simply means the black one, can be anywhere. If you open this famous gazetteer published by Selyansak and Mokotov, which is called Where Once We Walked, I'm sure you'll find quite a number of shtetlach called Czarna, the black one. Name in Russian or Ukrainian. It is very difficult to locate it on the map unless you know where it, in what province mm-hmm. it was situated.
Where it was near. Yeah, my aunt actually went back about a decade ago, and she said she wished she hadn't because she was just like, it was full of Polish peasants who really weren't interested in having Jews come and visiting them and taking the houses back that they had stolen. But that's for another time. So if you just
that's an interesting story. That's an interesting story, Rabbi Herschel, by the way. People coming back and not finding their towns and place. The moment Jews were out from many of these territories and from many of these towns, the towns really transformed themselves from towns into villages. So it means that the Jews were really not only the backbone of the economy, but they were the only urbanizers in these territories.
Mm-hmm. Now, I imagine the shtetl as being like these little, like, one-street towns where it was a dirt road and it had, like, a store for where people would, like, maybe buy general merchandise or just a little tiny nothing of a place. Is that how big would you say the shtetls were?
Let me get back to your wonderful description of the shtetl, which is very often to be found in the memoirs and in the Bell Letter.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, many people imagine the shtetl as a small Jewish village with a majority of Jewish population, with one dirt street, with a kerosene store, in the middle of nowhere, in the godforsaken place of the world, where nothing happens but pogroms, and Jews are extremely poor here. This is a pretty much accurate image of some, but not of all, of the shtetlach late in the 1930s. But even in that particular period, most shtetlach would be big towns. Now, you're asking an important question, how big is the shtetl? Well, I'm looking at the shtetl in what I call the age of its glory, late 18th, early 19th century, about 50, 70 years that I define as the golden age shtetl. And I found what the Russian administrators in care of these new territories also found at the time. They found that the statistics doesn't tell you anything, because most of the shtetl that we know and that you can list, you know, momentarily just thinking about that particular part of the world, most of the shtetlach didn't have the majority of Jewish population. They had sometimes 40%, sometimes 60%, but in most cases not more than 60% of Jewish population.
Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me just a second. You're busting now. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Yochanan Petrovsky-Stern. You're busting now another myth, because I always imagined that since it's called a shtetl, and a shtetl is a Yiddish word, that these towns were pretty much exclusively Jewish, and they had like a small area for the non-Jews, because everybody, you need like a Shabbos person to come and light your stove or take your cholent off the stove or whatever like this. So here it is, you're shattering another myth that for the most part, these areas which were the Pale of Settlement, which was where Jews were relegated, were still a minority.
Let me tell you this. Yes, I'm doing just that. I'm debunking the myths. But I am not to blame for that. I'm taking the contemporary documents, very careful descriptions, the inventories on the Russian side and inventage on the Polish side, and they give you a pretty accurate description of what is going on there. And all of them give you the numbers. 45% of Jewish population, 47% of Jewish population, 51% of Jewish population. There is never 95%. It just doesn't happen at the time, which means that perhaps something else needs to be taken into consideration for us to think of the shtetl as a Jewish town. And I'm not saying this is a wrong description. I'm just saying we have to look elsewhere. And when I start looking at what the Jews do in the shtetl, not who they are in the shtetl, not how many Jews there are in the shtetl, but what they actually do, the situation changes radically. And that is a chiddush. That is one of the important things that I'm bringing into the fore. And I'm saying, yes, correct. Jews are never the majority in the shtetl, neither in the 19th, neither in the 80s, nor in the 19th century. But if you go to the marketplace, if you make a list of the tavern keepers in town, if you make a list of the guild merchants in town, if you make a list of the people who are active in international trade, you will get astonishing figures. 90%, 95% of all the people who trade in the marketplace and who own the stores in the marketplace are the Jews. 99% of the second and third guild merchants, that is to say, a special status within the hierarchy of merchants in the Russian Empire, they are Jewish. 90% of all the artisans, barrel makers, hat makers, tailors, shoemakers in any shtetl are the Jews. So, which means that Jews are overrepresented in what can be called the driving mechanism of the shtetl, the economic well-being of the shtetl. That is where the Jews are overrepresented. And from that perspective, of course, the shtetl is a Jewish town. So I'm emphasizing not how many Jews are in the shtetl, but what do Jews do in the shtetl. I'm emphasizing mm-hmm. verbs and not nouns.
Gotcha. Understood. I mean, it was surprising to me. I mean, one of the early part in the book you devote to Jewish smuggling because of the Russians' perception of, I guess, maybe xenophobia or whatever it was through Tsar Catherine and her successors, that they wanted to keep Western influences out, France, et cetera, and so they closed the border to unnecessary French luxuries. And there's a story involving Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, and Berdichev is a major city in this area that you're talking about.
Right.
Again, I imagine Berdichev as just being some little town with a road in the middle of it. And from your description of it, it was probably quite a large city, even though it was still called a shtetl. The story goes is that the head of the town, Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, who was the town rabbi, went to the town smuggler and asked for 3 yards of black silk because he wanted to make a new kapata for himself. This is on the day before Passover. And I was always imagining that where is it being smuggled from, since you're talking silk, and it's I know that China is at odds with Russia for hundreds of years, for centuries, that it must be it's Chinese silk which is being smuggled. Yet, I look at your book, it's probably most likely the silk was coming from Paris. So what was the deal with smuggling things this whole culture and economy with Jewish smugglers, Yochanan Petrovsky Stern?
Let me tell you this. Jews were not the only smugglers, but Jews were mostly the smugglers in that particular area at that particular time, late 18th, early 19th century, for three reasons. First, because they had been for centuries the international merchants who are taking, who are purchasing the commodities in Paris, and in northern Italy, and bringing them through Leipzig, sometimes through Danzig, sometimes through Prague, of course, through Lemberg, Lviv, Lvov, and Brody to Berdichev. Berdichev, on the other hand, is, of course, not a small town. Berdichev has 35,000 people at the time. It's a very big town, even a city from our perspective, but it is still a shtetl because it is a private Polish town until the 1860s. It is in the hands of the count of the Prince Radziwill, so it is a private Polish town, even though it is on the Russian territory. Now, once Russia realizes that people who are purchasing the commodities and bringing them from France to Russia are actually helping Russia to feed the French Revolution, they don't like that. And Catherine the Great decides to close the border, and she imposes restrictive tariffs on any kind of import. But it means that people cannot get the commodities. It means that Levi Yitzchak cannot buy for himself any silk to have his new kapota. It means that women cannot have ribbons, they cannot have corduroy, they cannot have any kind of velvet for their nice dresses. You know, when I'm given lectures on the book, I have PowerPoint presentation, and illustrating the importance of smuggling at the time, I'm showing the colorful and actually colored pictures of Jewish women from Galicia and from the Pale of Settlement made in the mid-19th century. And when you look at these pictures, you will be amazed. Everything which is on these women, everything, every bit of clothes that these women have on themselves, all these things are made of the smuggled goods, because none of these goods, none of these commodities, none of these types of textile can be bought in the internal Russia. All of that is smuggled from Austria, France, Prussia into the Russian Empire. So, which means that Jews are really functioning in a very interesting perspective as people who provide you with commodities otherwise outlawed by the state. You want to be fashionable, you want to look nice, go to a Jewish smuggler. So it really changes the perception of Jews as people of trade and, of course, creates links between Jews and fashion, and also between Jews and illegal activities. Illegal activities that benefit rank-and-file people, but this of the government.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Dr. Professor Yochanan Petrovsky Stern from Northwestern University, wrote a book, The Golden Age Shtetl, A New History of Jewish Life in East Europe. We're talking about the shtetl and trying to debunk most of, as many as we can in the short period of time, the myths that go with it. One of the myths that maybe it's not a myth, but it is, you can tell me if it is a myth, is that all the Jews in the shtetl, because the shtetl was such a pressure cooker environment, that everybody was religious. Everybody kept Shabbos, and all the women went to the mikveh, and everybody kept kosher. And all the boys went to cheder, went to proper Jewish schools. Is that true or is that myth? Just like a game show, truth or myth.
Let me tell you this. If you think about the Jews of the shtetl as the Black Yarmulke, yeshivish type of congregants of one of the Brooklyn synagogues, that would be a mistake. Of course, Jews have smugglers. Of course, Jews have criminals.
That's business.
Jews have gangsters. All of that is there. But all these people, until the mid-19th century, in any particular shtetl, they have one of the same set of values. They do not have Reform Judaism. They do not have Conservative Judaism. They have some people who are more secular, some people who are less secular. They have Jews who would perhaps travel over Shabbat on a wagon when nobody sees them. They have Jews who would then go to the synagogue and put on kapota and look like they are really, you know, ultra-Orthodox. You have men who are chasing after married women. You have quite a bit of promiscuity in the shtetl. However, all these people have one and the same set of values, which is called traditional Judaism. They have nothing else but that. Mm-hmm. Secularism as a concept is not there. Liberal trends in Judaism are not there. So, of course, there is a small yeshiva. Not in every shtetl, but some shtetlach would have a small yeshiva with 3-4 boys, not more than that. You would have perhaps 5, 15, 25, depending on the size of the shtetl, Hasidic shtiblach, where you can go and pray with a Hasidic quorum, with a Hasidic minion. You would have a major synagogue in town, which is most likely Ashkenazic, that is a Litvish synagogue, and that would perhaps be the only religious division between the people. But they are following different paths, and of course, nobody is trying to tell them what to do or how conduct their businesses, although, of course, the rabbi all the time tries to impose some more rigid rules on what can, what cannot be done on the market days and how people can or cannot trade with non-Jews. But in most cases, the shtetlach live according to the mercantile principle, which means that the economic benefit prevails and the religious concerns are put aside.
Mm-hmm. What brought about the downfall of the shtetl paradigm, that you had mass waves of Jews leaving that part of Europe from the 1880s to the 1920s.
You know, you will be amazed. Most people who are leaving Europe with a wave of the Great Migration after the, I would say, late 1870s and up to 1924, most of these people are not coming from the shtetl. Most of these people are coming from big cities. You have to be well-informed to be able to move. You have to have startup money to be able to move. You have to have the passport bureau where you can get your foreign passport to be able to move. This is not what is happening in the shtetl. Most shtetl people are still there. However, the migration from the shtetl and the decline of the shtetl starts not with the attempts of the Jews in the shtetlach to move to the west, but with the attempts of the Jews in the shtetlach to move to the big cities. And this happens in course of the East European urbanization, proletarianization of the masses, and of course industrialization of the Russian Empire and of Poland, which is at that time part of the Russian Empire. Industrialization and urbanization are two things that kill the shtetl. I'll give you one example. You suddenly have in the second half of the 19th century huge footwear manufacturing industries in Odessa, and huge textile industries and ready-made clothes industries in Lodz, in Poland, right? Which means that a person, instead of going to a tailor or to a shoemaker asking for a pair of shoes or for a coat to be made, goes to a store and gets everything ready-made. That is something that makes the life of Jewish artisans in the shtetl absolutely miserable. They cannot compete with big business.
It's like that's the malls moving to the suburbs and killing those little mom-and-pop shops.
Right. So, and where do these artisans go? They need to abandon their businesses and they move to big cities where they become blue-collar workers, hired workers. Forget about Shabbat. They have 7 days working week. They work 17 hours per day, and so on and so forth. That is the beginning of the decline of the shtetl and the proletarianization of the Jewish masses. Something that would bring thousands and thousands of impoverished Jews into the embrace of the Bund, of the Jewish Marxist Socialist Party in East Europe. And that would actually make the shtetl lose its economically most active and most vibrant and most promising constituents.
Mm-hmm. Understood. We're running out of time, so I just have one question for you, if we can. It's 1825. And you, Yochanan Petrovsky Stern, have a choice of where you want to live anywhere in Eastern Europe, from Poland all the way to Moscow. Where would you choose to live? What would be the best place for a Jew to be?
Let me tell you, Moscow and also St. Petersburg are far beyond the pale. They are really beyond the pale. And to be there, I have to be a very wealthy merchant, which I have no desire to be. So physically, in 1825, I have no chance to be in Moscow or St. Petersburg. Also, Warsaw does not allow Jews in. There are some 100 Jews of Warsaw living there. Also very wealthy and privileged Jews. Other Jews live on the other side of the River Vistula in a special Jewish district called Praga. But I would go to live in Vilna or in Berdichev. I would prefer Berdichev. This is where the marketplace is vibrant. This is where a lot of education, a lot of interesting trends in education are taking place. This is where the Hasidic courts are established, and so on and so forth. I would like to be in Berdichev.
Okay, very good. That's going to wrap it up for us again. Our guest has been Yochanan Petrovsky Stern. He's a professor of Judaic Studies at Northwestern University. Just wrote a book, The Golden Age, Shtetl, A New History of Jewish Life in Eastern Europe, published by Princeton University Press, available on Amazon and everywhere, wherever else good books are found. Thank you so much, Yochanan, for coming in and enlightening us about the shtetl.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Why go anywhere else when you could go to One Stop Kosher? Located on Greenfield Road, just south of 696, you're never far from One Stop Kosher. At One Stop Kosher, you'll find the largest selection of kosher wines in Michigan. One Stop Kosher has the freshest produce, the best dairy, deli, and meats. They're gourmet. They even have a kosher bakery right on the premise. It's One Stop Kosher on Greenfield Road in 696 for all your shopping needs. Hey, Shulfin, here you're listening to the Jewish Hour. It's time for some music. The group is Pardes. They've been around for a while, but they're making a real big splash now in Israel. And this is a Jewish standard, done not so standardly, called Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Jerusalem of Gold. Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale. Hey, Shulfin, you're listening to the Jewish Hour. The time is fleeting. This is Daniel Hoffman, Hungarische Klezmer Fiddlerei, which means a Hungarian fiddle player. Thank you.
Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Hey, Herschel Finman, here we got time for one more. Schlockrock came out with a new album. I think this is number 30 or something like that. What he did was he took the best of Schlockrock songs and did them all a cappella. So we're going to listen to Minion Man from the new CD called Schlockapella.
6 o'clock on a summer Friday afternoon. Shabbos is an hour away. I walked around the town wondering what to do. Shabbos is no time to be feeling blue.
And two more. I went into a shop that red closed on the door.
There was a minion in the back of a hardware store.
Nine men waiting for one more. We ushered in the Shabbos with a beautiful song. The chazan had a voice that was clear and strong. Then Marit came again. I had to be moving now.
I asked the man, I saw how many Jews in this town. He said to me, there used to be a minion around. But one of us passed away and we've been feeling down. Yet now it seems as though another Jew has been found. For Shabbos, Minion Man.
About it every now and then, cause the place is still dear. And when I make this trip through Mobile once every year, I remember the men who prayed here.
Now the minion is gone, a few died, some moved on, but the back of the store still remembers the song. The nine men who waited till one came along.
How Shabbos was carried on a song.
Whoa. I asked the man, I saw how many Jews in this town. He said to me, there used to be a minion around.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Vayikra. It is the beginning of the book of Leviticus. This Shabbos, we read a special Haftorah. It is the Haftorah for Parshas Chodesh to remind us that we have to start getting ready for Passover. It also happens to be the new moon. So this is unusual that we read from three Torah scrolls on this Shabbos. Quite unusual. I suggest going to shul just to witness this phenomena that doesn't happen. It can only happen actually three times. On Simchas Torah, on the new moon of Hanukkah, if it falls on Shabbos, and the way it is right now. So there's a connection now then between Vayikra, the beginning of the Parsha, and Passover. The main point, the main thrust of the book of Leviticus is are the sacrifices. As it says right in the beginning of the portion, Adam ki yakriv mikem korban, when a person will offer up among themselves a sheep. The verse we know is grammatically incorrect. It should say when a person among you will offer up a sheep, not when a person will offer from among you a sheep. The idea in it being is that when we're talking about a sacrifice, the idea is to come close to God. The word korban doesn't mean sacrifice. It means to communicate, to come close to God. That we can still do. So now, Passover is coming. What's the idea of Passover? It says that the Almighty says, I and he cannot live together. When is that? When the person is saying, I, with a capital I. When the person is saying, I'm also a something. I was able to accomplish such and such. I didn't need any help from anybody or anything. So God says, okay, fine, you're on your own. But Passover is a lesson in humility, is how to get closer to God. Well, God's infinite. What contains infinity? Well, the answer, very simply, is nothing contains infinity. So if you want to really get close to God, make yourself a nothing, and you'll contain infinity. We have to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. The backup group with that plate on Minion Man with Schlacapella with Lenny Solomon was, of course, the Maccabees. Have to mention that. If you want to get in touch with me, the easiest way, RabbiFinman.com. You go to the website, you can contact me. Do you need shmura matzah? Go to my website, and right on the homepage is a way of getting it so that you get the best super premiest matzah in town at the lowest price, of course. You'll also find on RabbiFinman.com archived editions of the show. You'll find editions of the Hasidic U Story, the U Parsha, and the E Parsha, all different media of yours truly conveying, hopefully, entertaining and interesting insights into Judaism. You'll also find the absolutely necessary donations page. We're really behind at this point. Thank God the people at this wonderful station are very patient. But we're looking for, I think, what might be a miracle, because I'm envisioning that we're going to wind up. We did this once before. We paid 3 months suddenly all at once because somebody just came through and we were able to do it. We're still scraping together February. And where are we in March? The 15th? Yeah. Oh, today's the Ides of March. I would suggest if you don't want to beware the Ides of March, go to your computer, go to RabbiFinman.com, and go to the donations page. put in any donation of any amount that you want, and hit click, and then it'll all be done. Simple as that. The whole thing should take you less than 2 minutes. And you will ensure that the Jewish Hour, now in its 19th year, will continue. This month is the month of March. It's membership month. So any donation of $36 this month or more will receive a CD. So when you make your pledge, there's no special thing for it on the website, but when you make a contribution of more than $36, you have a chance to leave a note. Leave a note. What sort of genre of music you prefer, so that we can say, of course, Jewish genre. We know we have everything from Jewish rockabilly to klezmer to avant-garde to Jewish rock to Avram Fried to all that stuff. Tell us what you like, and we'll drop you a CD in the mail for your donation of $36 or more. Do it today. Go to RabbiFinman.com. We need you. And hopefully, if you're listening to us, you enjoy having us in your home once a week. It is, of course, radio worth listening to. Everybody knows that smoking isn't healthy. Smoking is really bad. I remember, I'm old enough to remember, when the Surgeon General's warning went on the side of the cigarette packs that said something to the effect of, the Surgeon General recommends that you do not smoke as cigarette smoking may be injurious to your health. That's how it started way back when. I remember as a four-year-old, my mother giving me money and telling me to go down the corner. I didn't have to cross any streets. I had to go down to the corner, and she gave me money, and I would ask the man, can I have a pack of Chesterfield Kings, please? And I would get the pack of Chesterfield Kings. I would give him the quarter. He would give me back the 2 cents and a pack of cigarettes with a pack of matches. I would walk back, ask my mom if I could keep the 2 cents, and she would say no. And that went on until I went to school. You know, and one day my mother decided to quit. People didn't know that cigarette smoking was unhealthy. In fact, there was a time when people thought tobacco smoking was really a very good thing. Like, for example, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe was a chain smoker, 4 or 5 packs a day. He would light one cigarette with a cigarette that he had just gotten through smoking. And he would do this 6 days a week. In 1941, this is after coming to America, being suffering from multiple sclerosis and other ailments, he went to a doctor, and the doctor asked him he should put out the cigarette during the exam, and he told them, the doctor happened to mention, cigarette smoking is not healthy for you. You shouldn't smoke. So he put out the cigarette. At the end of the exam, the doctor reached into his own coat pocket. This doctor was smoking. And he took out a pack of cigarettes to light up, and he handed a pack of cigarettes to the Friedrich Rebbe, to the previous Rebbe, and said, here, take one. And the Friedrich Rebbe said, I don't smoke. He said, what are you talking about? I just saw you smoking. He said, that was before I knew it was injurious to my health. Now that you tell me I'm not allowed to do it, it says Ushmartim is nafshasechem. It says clearly in the Torah that you have to guard your health and stay healthy. So now I'm not going to smoke. And the Friedrich Rebbe went from 4 or 5 packs of cigarettes a day to none instantaneously. So now that we know that it's not healthy, so don't ever start smoking. And if you do smoke, try and stop. And try and stop again. It's a good thing. Like the expression is, keep quitting. Don't quit quitting. That's it. That's going to do it for the show. We actually got a request from the girls in Chicago. You may remember them. They wanted to hear the band Zusha. So we're closing with Zusha. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you again next week. Take care.